and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, last month, a U.S. Border Patrol supervisor in Texas was charged with murdering four women and attempting to murder a fifth. He'll be tried on capital murder charges. This alleged crime is extreme, but Border Patrol agents are arrested for committing crimes all the time. Just last year, 254 Border Patrol agents were arrested for drug and alcohol-related crimes, domestic abuse, abuse of power, and other crimes. Next, the Saudi government is preparing to announce that the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi was an interrogation gone wrong. But some of the most powerful people in Washington say that admission isn't good enough, and they're calling for sanctions on Riyadh. Meanwhile, Saudi watchers say Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman may have gone too far in ordering the killing and may have put his own position in jeopardy. Then, 50 years ago, on October 16, 1968, black athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their black-gloved fists in the air during the U.S. national anthem while on the medal podium at the Olympics. The third athlete on the podium was Australia's Peter Norman, who joined them in wearing a human rights badge on his uniform. The International Olympic Committee president threatened to ban the entire U.S. track team, and as a result, Smith and Carlos were expelled from the Games. And then the Russian Orthodox Church yesterday cut ties with the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, the body seen as the spiritual authority of the world's Orthodox Christians. The row is seen as the greatest split in Christianity since the Orthodox and Catholic churches split in the year 1054. There's no disagreement whatsoever on dogma. Instead, the fight is over who should have authority over Ukraine's Orthodox, Russia or Constantinople. And finally, North and South Korea agreed on Monday to begin reconnecting rail and road links in another step toward improving bilateral relations, despite U.S. concerns over North Korea's nuclear arsenal. The two also began demining procedures in the demilitarized zone. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to U.S. immigration and brutality against immigrants. Last month, a U.S. Border Patrol supervisor in Texas was charged with murdering four women and attempting to murder a fifth. He'll be tried on capital murder charges. The alleged crime is extreme, but Border Patrol agents are arrested for committing crimes all the time. Just last year, 254 Border Patrol agents were arrested for drug and alcohol-related crimes, domestic abuse, abuse of power, and other crimes. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona, by Isabel Garcia, co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Isabel, welcome back.
Horrible topic, but thank you for having me back.
We keep having you back about horrible topics because the situation at the border and for immigrants and for those communities is horrible. It's really, really bad. You know, up here in Washington, D.C., where we are, we read about stuff at the border, but we don't really know because it's so far away and we're not touched by it. But you are. You're in Arizona. Talk about this story about the criminal conduct of Border Patrol agents.
Well, we have been talking about Border Patrol brutality for so very long. I mean, Michael Elmer shot and killed Darío Miranda Valenzuela back in 1993. You know, we have launched, you know, campaigns to bring justice in a regular criminal case. If these weren't immigrants, if it was a regular person, these people would be convicted of all kinds of atrocious behavior. But because they're immigrants, there is a whole reign of impunity by the Border Patrol. I mean, here we're facing, on October the 23rd, it's so real, we're facing the retrial on lesser charges for the murder of Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez, a 16-year-old kid that they murdered. And, of course, a jury. I heard the closings and what the evidence was. He should have been found guilty of second-degree murder, but instead they acquitted him.
Isabel, go over the details of that case, if you would.
Yes, well, on October the 10th of 2012, Jose Antonio Elena was walking on the street that runs parallel to the border fence. If you look up, you know, 45, 50 feet up, you see a cliff on the U.S. side. And on top of that is, you know, 15 feet of the metal wall that we have. They call it fence, but they're metal bars separated by 4 inches. And many of you have seen these photographs. So Lonnie Schwartz claims that on the night of October the 10th, that he was so scared for his life that he had to go to the fence and put the guns through that 4-inch gap and shoot him. And he went back and reloaded 2 more times. And the defense attorney argued, hey, he had fear for his life on that very first shot. And you know what? He died on that first shot. He killed him. And all the other 9 bullets that he riddled his body with are irrelevant.
Why didn't he shoot him? Outside of the fearing for his life. But in other words, he shot through a fence.
He shot. And when you say through a fence, again, the fence doesn't quite say it. You can be scared and shoot a fence. You're not going to be afraid of ricochet. We're talking about these metal rods. That's the fence we're talking about. And he reloaded and stuck his gun back in to shoot him 10 times. And at trial, like all the coward Border Patrol agents that go on trial, they're hot shots and mean people out in the field. And when they come to the courts, they're all, oh, I was so scared for my life. There were other police officers. They all, city police officers, sheriffs, they were all around there because there was report about that there were drugs being, marijuana being tossed over the fence or something. And so the police showed up. They all testified. None of them had any fear. None of them. None of them had fear. And yet impunity reigns supreme. Michael Elmer got off. Nicholas Corbett shot and killed Francisco Dominguez. He got off. I mean, it reigns. Impunity reigns. As since January of 2010, at least 81 people have died at the hands of the Border Patrol agents, including these women here. And we have absolutely no justice along the border. No justice. People need to understand that there is no justice. What are they saying about Claudia Lopez, the young woman that they killed in the Laredo little bushes? I mean, the guy changed his story because, you know, they're forced to, right? Either cameras or other witnesses or forensic evidence shows that they're liars. They lie over and over and over again.
What was that case?
Claudia Patricia Lopez was murdered in Laredo just months ago during the summer. The agent claimed that there were some guys that picked up some things to hit him with, and that's not true. He just shot the woman, and I don't know if they charged him with anything because it's unbelievable. And this guy only got caught because a woman was able to get away. In the case of Claudia Patricia, her whole name was Claudia Patricia Gomez Gonzalez. She was 20 years old from Guatemala and right close to Laredo. It's Rio Bravo. And the Border Patrol agent killed her as she tried to, you know, cross the border. And then, of course, he changed the story over and over again. They all changed their story.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of the media reports about it. At first, they said that she attacked an agent, or the migrants who were with her attacked an agent with blunt objects, prompting him to fatally shoot her. But then they changed it completely. They then say, oh, well, that wasn't the story. The story was they were involved in illegal activity. In other words, that's a completely different story, and neither may be true, but they have to come up with some explanation. You know, I want to ask you about this because I was in Texas a little bit in the early 1980s. I was doing organizing at that time against the KKK, and they were sort of ascendant at that time. There was a lot of white supremacist activity. So I came from the north. I was in New York City, but I came down with some people to help organize. We were asked for some support. And one of the things that I learned about Texas was if the Texas Rangers were coming to a demonstration, people knew there would be violence. They knew there would be violence because the Texas Rangers just had that reputation. And it sounds to me like that's the same reputation people have for the U.S. Border Patrol. In other words, when these guys show up, they can do and they will do anything. And the employment of violence is not secondary. It's not incidental. It's not accidental. It's routine. Is that right?
It's routine, and they control. We have given so much power to them that the Tohono O'odham Nation, the people live in fear. You need to look this up. There's a video of the Border Patrol officer ramming a First American, a Native American, at the reservation. And the local governments find it very, very, very difficult for whatever it is, whether money pressures, whether whatever it is, the local authorities are not able to take care of their own members. You can see it in the video. Nobody's been charged. Border Patrol agent hasn't been charged. We've heard nothing. This happened about 4 weeks ago. 4 or 5 weeks ago, and there is a cam-dash video. It's being videoed by somebody and released. I mean, the Border Patrol agents have been caught, of course, slashing, you know, water jugs that No More Deaths and other people put out. But the brutality is the most egregious. And you saw the lack of any concern by CBP, that's Customs and Border Patrol agent, in separating families. You know, everybody talks about ICE, and yes, I hate ICE too. But who do you think separated all those families? Who do you think caused that division? Who do you think didn't track those children? Who do you think didn't care? And it was the Border Patrol.
That was the U.S. Border Patrol. You know, Juan David Ortiz, the Border Patrol intelligence supervisor, what he's charged with is basically being, he's a serial killer, it looks like.
Yes, he's a serial killer. In the Marines, had been a Marine or in the services, and you know, we're making a huge push. All our politicians are making a huge push that anybody who's been in war, imagine, to come and work at the border. And so it's pretty frightening to all of us. And this guy obviously didn't have much recruitment, screening. I mean, and they want to hire more Border Patrol agents when the ones we have are troubled already. We have a troubled agency that should be halted immediately. Do you know that during the child separation thing, it was CBP who decided that a fully one-third of the single males were not prosecuted? Instead, they focused on the families. So CBP is a cruel agency, and it takes a lot to say that, because I've worked on this for decades, and the cruelty is beyond the pale at this point.
Yeah, so not just abolish ICE, but abolish Border Patrol.
Oh yeah, to me, the Border Patrol, their reign of impunity, the brutalization of people. We have videos. I mean, they killed Anastasio Hernandez, and you have it on video, and they said, no, we're not going to charge him. They tasered him to death, do you remember, at the port of entry in San Diego, and it was all captured on camera. Did we get justice there? No.
That's the voice of Isabel Garcia. She is the co-founder of the Coalición de Derechos Humanos. We've been talking to her from Tucson, Arizona. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The Saudi government is preparing to announce that the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi was an interrogation gone wrong. But some of the most powerful people in Washington say that this admission isn't good enough, and they are calling for sanctions on Riyadh. Meanwhile, Saudi watchers say Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman may have gone too far in ordering the killing and may have put his own position in jeopardy. And there is also a split within Washington over the U.S. government's relationship with the Saudi government and with the leadership of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince. We're going to talk about all of that. Whitney Webb is talking to us from the southern part of Chile. She is a journalist and a staff writer for Mint Press News, and we're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Hi, thanks for having me on the program.
Thank you for joining. Whitney, let's just go over the latest news and the Turkish authorities. And of course, we're recording this show at 1:50 p.m. East Coast time. So by the time it broadcasts in a couple hours, there may be other breaking news. But it appears that the Turkish authorities have been inside the home of the consulate officialdom in the Saudi consulate officials overseeing the Saudi consulate. with the idea that perhaps the journalist was killed there. Is that the latest?
Seems to be the case. So Turkish authorities today were given the authority to go inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And what they found, they claim, was certain evidence, quote unquote, that Jamal Khashoggi had been killed inside. But the exact nature beyond some statements about like new paint being up in the consulate, for example, that's really the only, quote unquote, evidence that's been publicly released so far. I'm sure more will be forthcoming as this continues to develop.
There seems, Walter, to be two different messages in Washington right now. Donald Trump says, it looks like this may have been a rogue operation. Mike Pompeo went and met with the Saudi king and his son, the crown prince, the real power, Mohammed bin Salman. Also, the idea being that there would be a story that this was an interrogation gone wrong. I looked at the New York Times today and the Wall Street Journal. Both of them said, kind of dubious that it's a rogue operation gone wrong, but it would be a sufficient explanation so that U.S. could continue to do business as usual with Saudi Arabia. And yet at the same time, Lindsey Graham, leading Republican hawk from the Senate, and people like Marco Rubio, a different message altogether, demanding, in fact, sanctions and punishment against Saudi Arabia. What's your take?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing to point out is the immense hypocrisy of people like Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham, who were completely happy to sign off on arms sales to the Saudis, you know, for their ruthless war in Yemen. Some people call it a genocidal war in Yemen, you know, and a whole host of other regimes that the United States does business with around the world, or perhaps even installed themselves. But I think that what's going on now, the reason why there's been a change in their orientation is that I think they believe, and they probably are right, that there could be a different constellation of forces in Saudi Arabia, one that's less unpredictable, like Mohammed bin Salman has proven to be, and that new constellation of forces would maintain the fundamental foreign policy orientation of the Saudi government since its foundation, which is to be a loyal ally, a lieutenant of the United States in the Middle East.
Whitney, what about that? There's a discussion about this because Saudi Arabia was for many, many, many decades not just simply an ally, but a client, really, of the United States. And there's been some feeling that as the United States got bogged down in the Middle East, mired in the U.S. inability to pacify Iraq, the chaos in Libya, the inability of the U.S. to overthrow the Assad government, that Saudi Arabia, under the crown prince, decided to grow some wings and have an independent foreign policy. And perhaps there are people in Washington who don't want that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that we're talking about Lindsey Graham, it's important to point out some other things that are in play here that haven't really gotten much coverage, but are very relevant to Lindsey Graham in particular. That being that 2 days before Khashoggi disappeared, the Saudis failed to meet a deadline for their planned purchase of Lockheed Martin's really expensive missile defense system, $15 billion. And they have been eyeing buying the Russian-made equivalent on the S-400 instead of going through with the Lockheed Martin purchase. And in Graham's case, Lindsey Graham, even though he's always been, as Walter mentioned, for Saudi arms sales, there is a concern that because the Saudis did not meet this deadline, they may not meet or they may not follow through with a lot of their planned purchases that were part of this $110 billion weapons deal that was touted last year by Trump personally. So in Lindsey Graham's case, for example, his top campaign contributor is Lockheed Martin. So I think this is definitely a role in what is sort of, this definitely has had an influence on affecting Graham's rhetoric in particular, leading him to push against MBS, who obviously was behind this decision in terms of defense equipment, because even before Crown Prince, he was defense minister in Saudi Arabia. So he definitely controls these sort of decisions. So I think Lindsey Graham in particular is hoping to see someone that would be more friendly to buying American in terms of weapons be put in place instead of MBS. And there's also some other elements within the U.S. power structure that would like to see MBS go, mainly because the former crown prince that MBS removed, Mohammed bin Nayef, he was really close to a lot of elements in the CIA. He even won a medal from the CIA. And there's been a concern that, as was mentioned, Mohammed bin Salman is unpredictable and impetuous, and he is closer to Trump and Kushner and co, and not so close to U.S. intelligence as Banayev is. And, you know, the U.S. intelligence community has an established track record of working with Banayev, and would likely prefer to return to that instead of having to do damage control for MBS, bringing, you know, this sort of special relationship between the U.S. and the Saudis under scrutiny like it is right now, thanks to the disappearance of apparent murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham, Walter, said on TV on Fox News, he, meaning MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, the real power in Saudi Arabia, quote, he had this guy murdered in a consulate in Turkey. This is Graham talking on Fox and Friends on Tuesday. And to expect me to ignore it, I feel used and abused. I was on the floor every time defending Saudi Arabia because they're a good ally. I'm starting to get tears about Lindsey feels right. Really, really abused, Walter.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty outrageous, I think, for Lindsey Graham to be putting it in exactly those terms. But yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, the sentiment is that the Saudi government, Mohammed bin Salman in particular, has just gone too far. I mean, you know, the U.S. government doesn't really care who the individual who gets, you know, this position or that position in the Saudi government is, as long as they maintain the same fundamental foreign policy orientation. And when the competition, the jostling for position within a client elite like the Saudi monarchy is a client elite, when that becomes too destabilizing to the overall system, it becomes annoying to the patron because it's not really important to them. What's important to people like Lindsey Graham is if Saudi Arabia is conducive to U.S. hegemony in the Middle East.
Whitney, I'm glad Walter said that the U.S., whenever it targets a government, it always complains about the form of government. It's not democratic enough. It's not liberal. It doesn't embrace our liberal democracy, blah, blah, blah. But actually, the U.S. government doesn't care about the form of government. In the case of Saudi Arabia, it's a monarchical dictatorship. There are 15,000 princes and princesses, so there's a lot of factions. But it's a blood family. It's a dictatorship. It's the opposite of democracy or anyone's notion of democracy. What does matter to the United States, what really does matter to the United States, is that the Saudis are the largest, I believe the largest seller of oil still within OPEC, and what happens there could have a big impact on oil prices, and it also has a big impact on U.S. Geostrategic plans for this resource-rich region. Go ahead, we have 2 minutes left.
Like you said, the Saudis in the relationship with the U.S. It has always been crucial, but it's particularly crucial right now because Trump has sort of built his relationship with Saudi Arabia as the cornerstone of his Middle East policy. This is particularly true when we look at the upcoming deadline in November 4th, where the U.S. is going to try and cut off entirely Iranian exports to the international community. They are depending on Saudi Arabia to increase oil supply to prevent a huge jump in the price of oil that would obviously occur when Iranian oil exports are, in theory, taken off the market coming up in early November. If the Saudis, because of this, these growing tensions, decide not to do that, it could have really huge consequences for the U.S., the Trump administration's Iran policy in particular, and economic consequences here at home, potentially right before the midterm elections, which is something Trump doesn't want to do. Which I think in part explains why Trump is sort of playing a good cop here, sort of when he stated that about earlier about the rogue elements made behind the killing, trying to sort of like paint a way out for the Saudis in terms of Jamal Khashoggi, because he knows that this is a really sensitive situation. But obviously, as I alluded to earlier, the possibility that the Saudis could be buying Russian weapons instead of U.S. weapons is sort of like a kick to the stomach to Trump, because his foreign policy in general has been really built around weapon sales. And if he can't even get the Saudis to buy the Lockheed Martin missile defense system, it's going to be really hard for him to try and seal the deal with other countries around the world for that same system when the S-400 made in Russia is cheaper and more attractive.
Those are excellent points. That was Whitney Webb. We were talking to Whitney from Chile. We usually say Santiago, but she's actually about 10 hours south of Santiago. Whitney Webb, thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us your insights. We were also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
50 years ago, on October 16th, 1968, black athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their black-gloved fists in the air during the U.S. national anthem while on the medal podium at the Summer Olympics. The third athlete on the podium was Australia's Peter Norman, who joined them in wearing a human rights badge on his uniform. The International Olympic Committee president threatened to ban the entire U.S. track team, and as a result, Smith and Carlos were expelled from the Games. We're joined here in the studio by Eugene Puryear. He's the host of By Any Means Necessary, which is on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area between 2 and 4 p.m. just before this show. And it's also on iTunes, Spotify, Spreaker, and iHeartRadio anytime. Good to see you, Eugene.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me.
Eugene, I think probably every American, or at least every American of a certain age, is familiar with that iconic photograph of Tommy Smith and John Carlos standing on the podium in 1968 after winning the gold and silver medals. And then they were soon expelled. Tell us the story.
I mean, it's a very interesting story. And I think at first it has to really be contextualized by what was going on in 1968. I mean, first and foremost, 10 days before the Olympics started in 68 in Mexico City, there was what's known as the Tlatelolco massacre of protesting students there as a part of a mass student movement in 1968. You had also had April 6th of that year, little Bobby Hutton of the Black Panther Party was killed. April 4th, Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. And of course, earlier that year, the Tet Offensive, which obviously started to turn the tide of public opinion decisively against the Vietnam War here in the United States, had probably already turned that way around the world, but notable for Walter Cronkite saying the war probably could not be won. So coming into this Olympics, everything was really on a hair trigger in so many ways of the tensions and the fault lines around the world. You also had here in the United States, Black Power had become such a massive rallying cry since it was first uttered in 1965 by the then Stokely Carmichael leader Kwame Ture. And earlier that year, in fact, of 1968, it might have been actually a month after, but around that same time, the second session of Congress that year, the Congress actually introduced the Community Self-Determination Act, which to some degree was a more conservative bill, but it had been written by Roy Innes of CORE, which at that time was a Black Power organization. And it showed to some degree how deeply this slogan had resonated to, you know, you had the uprisings as well in Newark and Detroit in 1967, that even the conservative members of the U.S. Congress, who certainly weren't great advocates for Black Power, still felt they had to make some concessions to the Black community that appeared to be genuflecting in the direction of understanding and respecting the fact that Black Americans were demanding not just equal rights, but self-determination in the areas where they where we made up the majority in terms of political control, economic opportunities, and the like. So all of that is the lead up to this massive event that is happening here. And there had been some ongoing issues going into the Olympics of people looking to organize athletes. There were many athletes who were obviously speaking out at this time. I think it was this year, might have been the year after that, where the UCLA basketball team, top-rated basketball team, Bill Walton, also very involved in these things, had made a lot of news. I guess it would have been later that year, given when the basketball season started. So you had athletes becoming more and more political. Obviously, Muhammad Ali, who the year before had been stripped of the belt for refusing to serve in Vietnam, serving as an inspiration for those individuals. So Tommy Smith, John Carlos, they wanted to make a statement. So they got up there, and everything they did was about the statement in and of itself. They were wearing the black socks because of the poverty issue. I believe it was Tommy Smith had his jacket unzipped there, which was in solidarity with blue-collar workers in the United States. There was beads, I believe. One of them was wearing beads, which was to symbolize the broader piece of the slave ship. There was a human rights badge that all of them, including the Australian gentleman, both wore. And then they decided to put their fist up in what was the universal symbol of Black Power. So they chose to use this, one of the greatest stages. And this is, you know, 1968. So it's not like every single thing is on satellite television. This is one of the few things that every single person in the world who cares at all about sports or is in any degree patriotic is watching. They decided to use this stage in order to make a strong statement against not only oppression of Black people in the United States, not only the drive for Black individuals for self-determination, but for the rights of working class individuals in this country and more generally for human rights around the world. So very much a part and parcel of the broader maelstrom they were caught up in that is the year 1968. And part of the reason why now, today, 50 years on, this is such a widely celebrated anniversary because it was such a consequential year for the world.
And Colin Kaepernick.
Kaepernick.
Well, and you know, with Colin Kaepernick, who I think is the first athlete to really evoke this level of not only what took place at the Olympics, but being willing to risk it. Because as you mentioned, they were eliminated from the Olympic team and eliminated from all future Olympic competition. And certainly what we saw with Muhammad Ali, of course, he had his belt stripped of them. So in that era, you had athletes who were saying, we're going to put it all on the line, our entire career, and they did, and they paid the price.
When they were at their peak.
That's right. At their peak. Colin Kaepernick also, more or less at the peak of his career. I mean, he played pretty well. I don't want to get too deep into the Colin Kaepernick's sort of record.
But not over the hill.
Not over the hill. Definitely could have still played. Definitely was someone who before this, many, many teams would have looked at the very least as their second string guy. I would say there's six or seven teams that he could have started for based on what their scheme may have been. Definitely not someone you would have thought would have been out of the league. Definitely not someone who you thought their career was over. But in fact, he had at least, I would say, 5-6 years left, even if he wasn't a starter. And maybe more if he had been able to get out there and really show what he had, like he did for the 49ers when he first came on the field and electrified the team. But be that as it may, he was willing to risk it all. And I think what many people don't know about Colin Kaepernick is how engaged he was. He actually audited a class on Black history at the University of California in Berkeley the summer before he ever kneeled, because he wanted to make sure that he really knew what was going on, what was happening, what the antecedents were, what the real problems were that existed in the Black community. The individual who taught that class said that Kaepernick was his best student. They are on time every single day, the whole time, taking notes, asking questions. So he seriously got ready, seriously prepared. The woman he dates, who's also a relatively political person, she's a well-known radio TV host, Nessa, also was someone who was able to point him to certain resources about the international struggle, the Palestinian struggle, different pieces like this. So he really deeply studied the social problems in the world before deciding to take a stand. Then he decided to take the original stand by sitting on the bench. Then he ends up meeting with a guy who is a conservative veteran, reaches out to him. He says, hey, let's meet. So he doesn't blow the guy off. He says, hey, let's meet. They talk. This individual, whose name is I'm just blanking on right now, he says, you know, I'd like it if you did a little something different than sitting. Maybe you could kneel, and that could be the way to do it. And then he kneels, and the rest is history. Eric Reed, who also knelt with him, was out of the league, back in the Panthers this year, continuing to kneel. And so I think we've seen, along with Kenny Steeles and Albert Wilson, I think what we're going to see is a new growth of athletes, just like in the late 60s, where they said, our lives and our careers are not so big that they can't be sacrificed for the greater good, because so many negative things are happening to so many people, and we are some of the rare individuals that, like, everyone knows, and that most people will pay attention to us when we say something, and we're going to put our careers or whatever it takes on the line. Maybe nothing, maybe everything, but we're going to do it and let the chips fall where they may. And I think that's something that I at least very much respect about what Kaepernick did.
I do too. And you know, you hear a lot of politicians who, once they leave office, they start to sound a little bit more progressive because they're not running, you know, like they have that freedom. When you risk everything, you risk a high-paying career, you risk, these people didn't just become good at football. They spent their entire life, or good at track in the case of Tommy Smith and John Carlos. They devoted their entire life, their waking hours. They struggled. They worked out. They trained and trained and trained. And yet for their people, or for society, for justice, they did this thing. I mean, let's face it, it's heroic. And heroism is an important part of movements. Like if you have a good thing to say, good. But are you willing to risk something? Are you out there? That's the thing that inspires people. And that's why I can remember, because I was 14 years old and a sports buff and watching the Olympics, we fell off our chairs. We could not believe that something like this happened. It was like a volcano. And it was 1968. So they catalyzed a movement, but they also reflected a movement.
Yeah, no, I think that's very much the case. I think that's what's most notable when you look at the involvement of athletes in the late 60s. Of course, we can add Jim Brown. We can add Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. We can add all the people whose names we're never really going to know in this sort of broader piece here, is that they didn't see themselves. I once saw Bill Walton talk about this. They were asking him about a famous photo of the UCLA basketball team leading the charge, trying to, I think, break into a recruitment center. And, you know, Bill Walton's, what, 6'10", 6'11", 6'11", and there he is at the top with a coat rack trying to break in the window so they can get in there. And they were asking him to reflect on it, and he was like, well, of course we were basketball players, but he was like, we were on the UCLA campus, one of the most political, radical campuses, and just like other students, we were caught up. We were a part of this movement. We wanted to be a part of this movement, and we were there alongside the other students, not as some sort of separate and apart piece from it. And I think we see that over and over again when people talk about those times. It was about the movement and people who felt compelled to be joining with these other millions of people because they felt just like them. And despite the fact they had a much higher platform, we're basically feeling like, hey, we're rank and file soldiers, shoulder to shoulder, and we'll do what we have to do just like you will.
Eugene Puryear is our guest. Eugene, about 60 seconds left. Let's talk about young people, because young people look to sports figures in particular. They're the celebrity. They are from the community frequently. What's the impact?
I think it's huge. And I think it's also vice versa. I mean, the LeBron Jameses of the world and individuals like that who are speaking out a lot, who have so much on the line in terms of contracts and money and all those different sorts of things, they wouldn't be speaking out on these issues unless they thought the base of their support, the young people playing the sports, pushing their parents to buy them the gear, working the side jobs and hustling at the basketball court to get them the stuff, that those people wouldn't stand with them. And I think it shows through when you look at how many of these athletes have stood up, how they feel the young people are not only identifying, but perhaps driving them to it.
And sometimes you just know in your heart that you're on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There are some issues that are just so clear that you know you're doing the right thing.
I agree with you. Cam Newton, wake up.
That's right. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We were joined here in the studio by the great Eugene Puryear. He's the host of a terrific show, By Any Means Necessary, which precedes this show from 2 to 4 p.m. It's on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area, and it's also on anytime at iTunes, Spotify, Spreaker, and iHeartRadio. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host, Brian Becker. The Russian Orthodox Church yesterday cut ties with the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, the body seen as the spiritual authority of the world's Orthodox Christians. The row is seen as the greatest split in Christianity since the Orthodox and Catholic churches split in the year 1054. There's no disagreement whatsoever on dogma. Instead, the fight is over who should have authority over Ukraine's Orthodox, Russia or Constantinople. But is modern-day geopolitics the real cause of this split? We're joined from Washington by Jim Jatras. He's a political analyst, a former U.S. diplomat, and a former senior foreign policy advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
We should tell our listeners, too, Jim, that coincidentally, you and I are both Greek Orthodox. I consider myself to be a little biased on this issue, but I'm dying to know your analysis. This thing has been bubbling along for months now, and when I talk about it with my friends and I say, this is bad. It's very bad, not just for the churches, but it's bad in terms of foreign relations and geopolitics. They just look at me with a blank stare. Tell us why this is so important.
Well, it's John, I'm glad you pointed out that you and I both have a dog in this fight. Not only were we both Greek Orthodox, we're both under the authority of the Ecumenical Patriarch in Constantinople, which means I've been hearing from godchildren and friends and so forth in other jurisdictions saying, what? Does this mean we're not in communion anymore? We're not in the same church anymore? This is something with world historical potential that's very, very bad, not just in the world of religion, but in the world of politics. As we know, in a lot of countries in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism, Russia, Serbia, not just Orthodox countries, Poland, Hungary, and so forth, that the church has filled the void that was left by the end of communism, that it's the kind of the pillar of the social order and the moral order in many respects. And I think that's also implicit here as well. And I think that also partly explains why that, and I pointed this out in a recent piece I wrote for RT, that it seems that there's been some involvement of Western governments, particularly the U.S. State Department, in trying to move this thing along because they realize that it has consequences not only for the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, but for developments within Ukraine, which as this moves forward, very well could lead to violence, which, of course, will be blamed on the Russians.
You're absolutely right. You know, there, I don't want to get too down into the weeds, but I think there's a point that's very important here. And that is that the Orthodox Church in Constantinople, modern day Istanbul, is under constant pressure from the Turkish government. There was, until very recently, a law saying that the patriarch, the leader of the world's Orthodox Christians, who's always a Greek Orthodox, had to be a Turkish citizen. And we had gotten to a point for the first time in 1700 years where there were no more Greek Orthodox who were qualified for the position. The current ecumenical patriarch, Bartholomew I, was the last one. And so had he died without the law being changed, the Russian patriarch would have assumed the ecumenical patriarchate. So the Russians would have been in charge of the world's Orthodox. But President Erdogan changed the law, and he allowed any qualified hierarch of the Orthodox Church to apply for Turkish citizenship, and he granted that citizenship. So now there are a whole bunch of people who are qualified. Well, I think the Russians feel left out, and the Russians have been angry since this law was passed 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that, you know, history notwithstanding, this being the greatest split in 1,000 years, I think the Russians have had enough, and they're ready to go alone.
I think so, and it is interesting too, given the on and off warming of relationship between, if we will, Tsar Putin and Sultan Erdogan, that really does look in many respects like the old days between the Russian and the Ottoman empires. But you know, one of the things I think, not to get too far down the weeds, John, that I think confuses a lot of people is this notion of the Patriarch of Constantinople as somehow the leader of the church. We don't have a pope in Orthodoxy. He doesn't have that kind of authority. He simply has a precedence of honor, and that depends, rather dependent upon, his being the bishop of the imperial city of Constantinople, as it was for so many centuries. He doesn't have something similar to, say, the Petrine claim that the Pope of Rome has in his church. The reason this is important is, you know, for how many decades now we've been talking about 2,000 Orthodox Christians left in Constantinople. Well, it can't be that way 30 years later. I'd be surprised if they're more than a few hundred. And we're really looking at what is, in the old English expression, is a rotten borough. It's a church with no people but a bunch of bishops in it who are really not that responsible. And I think that's one reason they're so amenable to pressure. If it's true, the reports that we've seen that the State Department pointed to the malfeasance of funds over the St. Nicholas Shrine being rebuilt at the World Trade Center site that involved the ecumenical patriarchy, that indicates the extent to which maybe Patriarch Bartholomew is not so much malign in taking this effort in Ukraine, but maybe being buffeted about by outside forces. And that's one of the things that concerns me with that kind of political interference in the church with potentially disastrous consequences.
Well, let's talk about that, actually, because I think you raise an important point that, at least in the religious press, no one is talking about. The Greek Orthodox Church had a church at the site of the World Trade Center. It was right there in the shadow of the World Trade Center, and the two towers were built around it, sort of. And so it was kind of an ecumenical place where anybody could go in, you know, sit down, say a prayer, light a candle, do whatever they wanted to do. The church was, of course, destroyed. It was practically vaporized when the towers came down. And so it's in the process of being rebuilt. It's been a very long process, starting really on September the 12th, 2001. Something like $35 million has been raised to rebuild this church. The Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America, which is based right there in New York, led by a 91-year-old archbishop, seems to be missing $10 million. And Greek Orthodox who have donated money for the construction of this church are up in arms. Now, this is probably a bookkeeping error, and they've hired an outside accountant, and the accountant says the money's there somewhere. It's just been misplaced somehow. But I think a lot of people see the church as being poorly managed, at least financially, and it's at a weak point right now. And I wonder if the State Department decided to take advantage of that by pressing the Greek Orthodox Church of America and the Ecumenical Patriarchate in Constantinople, under which the Greek Orthodox Church of America falls, to make a move like this. You've written about it. What do you think?
Well, I think that's right. And I think that involves two other factors here. One is that given the poverty and paucity of a flock that Constantinople has at home, the Greeks in America and elsewhere in what they still quaintly call the diaspora are the cash cow for Constantinople. Without American Greek money, there would be no Constantinople, no ecumenical patriarchate. So I think that's one of the points of vulnerability. The other one is, I'm not sure it's just a bookkeeping error. There's reason to think up to $8 million went from the Greek Archdiocese to Constantinople to fund the abortive ecumenical council that was to be held in Crete in 2016. It's possible that part of that shortfall has to do with money that should have been used for St. Nicholas and instead went to Constantinople. So that would really link those two problems. I guess what I find most disturbing that our government would do that by implication, perhaps by saying, well, we see you've got this problem, but we could really use your help over there in Ukraine, is that it's being done under the guise of religious freedom in Ukraine, which of course has nothing to do with it. People can belong to whatever church they want to, but that has nothing to do with the position the State Department has now taken in a statement from Heather Nauert, the spokesman there, linking religious freedom to the awarding of autocephaly from Constantinople, which, by the way, has no such authority. So it's really gotten sort of the, and as I say, John, it's going to lead to violence. The fake patriarch Denisenko from Ukraine was here a couple weeks ago at the Atlantic Council, which, as you know, is very close to the NATO government and governments that doesn't know beans about religion. And he said in so many words that the Ukrainian government will be in a position to seize some of the major church complexes, especially the monasteries like the Caves Monastery in Kiev and the Pochayev Monastery in West Ukraine. There's no way that will happen peacefully. And he knows that. We'll also have the problem, he says, that the government, after a two-thirds vote of parishes, will allow a parish to switch from the canonical jurisdiction to the schismatics. Well, we know how this is going to happen. A bunch of strangers will show up at a parish, claim to be members, demand a vote, and then as soon as they vote two-thirds to move the jurisdiction, the police will come in and seize the church. This is going to be a very ugly process.
Jim, let's finish by talking about this chance of violence. It's as though the State Department, the Atlantic Council, the U.S. government has pushed these churches right to the brink of a proxy fight, really, is what it comes down to. Knowing that there's a possibility for violence, is there a way to back off?
There is. And the only way they can really back off is if Patriarch Bartholomew takes a step back. Look, the Church of Antioch, the Church of Serbia, the Church of Georgia, a lot of the local Orthodox churches have said, let's settle this in a conciliar way. Rather than having Constantinople act as a pope and wave his magic wand and determine what's the story with the Ukrainian church, let's get all of the sister local Orthodox churches together and find a way to reconcile this. And that is really the only path forward. That can happen, but it really depends on Constantinople. If Patriarch Bartholomew, with all due respect, wants to press forward with this because people in Washington want to see drive a further wedge between Russia and Ukraine for their own reasons, he's going to have to bear the responsibility for a lot of what happens.
That was the voice of Jim Jatras, who joined us from Washington. Jim is a political analyst, a former U.S. diplomat, and a former senior foreign policy advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. North and South Korea agreed on Monday to begin reconnecting rail and road links, another step towards improving bilateral relations despite U.S. concerns, I'm putting it mildly, let's put quotes around that, over North Korea's nuclear arsenal. The two also began demining procedures in the demilitarized zone. We're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Tim Beal, welcome back.
Good to be back, Brian.
I can't exactly find words that aptly describe how dramatic these events are, that the governments in North and South Korea could be demilitarizing what was wrongly called before the demilitarized zone. In fact, it was the most militarized part of the planet, taking out landmines. They're also going to have the soldiers on both sides, on the north and the south, give up firearms. They're not going to be armed shortly. That's the plan. I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
Yes, and it's all good stuff. But I think you're right. Your earlier comment is the connection of the railways and the road network, which is really the most significant thing. The DMZ thing is tension reduction, and that's very important. But the railways and the roads is much more positive. It's returning Korea to the past before the United States divided the Korean Peninsula in 1945.
Tim Beal is our guest. His recent book is Crisis in Korea. Tim talks to us from New Zealand. We're talking about the increasing tempo of relations, normalized relations between the governments of North and South Korea. Tim, you're right. It's the railroad links, the road links. That's the most important in terms of overcoming the division of Korea. One could not help but notice, however, that the United States, under the banner of the UN command, because the UN was the agency that went to war against North Korea in June 1950, it still exists, the UN command, it's really the United States, at the DMZ just a few weeks ago, they said, guess what, North Korea, South Korea, no, we're not going to let you build a railroad. What happened there? What does it indicate? And how can North and South Korea overcome it?
Well, that's a question. In a sense, it's not what North Korea can do; it's what South Korea can do. I mean, South Korea is the client state. North Korea is independent, and so whilst it has to pay attention, obviously, to the United States and savers and so forth, it has a certain freedom of action. It can, do what it can get away with, so to speak, like any other state. But South Korea is different because it's not independent. Its military is controlled by the U.S. There's huge pressure on the administration in various ways. And we had Donald Trump just say last week or so, they can't do anything without our approval. So South Korea is a place to watch. So it very much depends on how much they can go forward despite U.S. disapproval.
Well, here's the thing about Donald Trump. Donald Trump says what other politicians don't say. Sometimes he tells the truth, and that truth, he says, South Korea won't do it. They won't go forward with North Korea. They won't go forward without our approval. Now, that would have been fine language, blunt, frank, honest, candid language, say, in the 19th century, where Western powers didn't try to conceal their colonial status. They were proud of it. But since World War II and since the world decolonized, you're just not supposed to talk like that. But in fact, Donald Trump has demonstrated through his, maverick form of speaking or thoughtless form of speaking, the reality of it. And yet there is something that may be happening where South Korea doesn't exactly need Washington's approval. What about that?
Yeah, it's very difficult to pin this down. In theory, in a sense, South Korea can go ahead. It can defy the United States. It could lift sanctions. It could do all sorts of things that Americans disapprove of. And to some extent, to a large extent, I suppose, nothing very much the Americans could do about it. And they're not going to, send their troops from their base and take over the Blue House, the president's compound in Seoul, or anything like that. But, of course, what they can do is work with the South Korean military and South Korean conservative forces. And, worst comes to worst, they could have a coup. And it's not the first time the Americans have organized a coup. So there's always that in the background. So it's a very delicate balancing act that President Moon has to do between moving forward on all these necessary things, and quite frankly hasn't gone forward very far, but any movement has to be, he has to take into account, the pushback from the Americans and those forces within South Korea. So you have to be very cautious.
Tim Beal is our guest. Again, I want to go over for people listening to this who might not really understand. The U.S. always describes South Korea as an ally, and it always describes South Korea as a democracy. Now, there is something called the Combined Forces Command, CFC, and that's the organization that currently answers to the South Korean and American National Command Authorities in wartime. The CFC, the Combined Forces Command, is currently commanded by a U.S. four-star general. And ever since the Korean War, the, quote, allies, the United States and South Korea, have agreed that it will always be an American four-star general who will have operational control of both the Republic of Korea and U.S. military forces in wartime at the operational level of war, and again, within a highly integrated command structure. That means, structurally, South Korea is under and in the chain of command, but under the United States in a formal sense.
Yeah, I know, it's incredible because it's the only place in the world where this actually happens. I mean, obviously, the United States dominates all sorts of other countries, Japan and even mighty New Zealand, but it doesn't have direct operational control over the military. So this is something quite special in South Korea.
I want to ask you, Tim Beal, because you follow Korea events closely, the idea of reunifying a country that has two different social systems, how that works. Is it a confederal system where if there is reunification, the North stays the North, the South stays the South? The South is clearly dominated by capitalist property relations. It's a market economy, so to speak. The North is a planned economy. It has public property rather than, it has growing numbers of private enterprise, but it's still essentially public property. How does unification or reunification happen with two different social systems?
Well, I mean, you're quite right. Some sort of federation is the first step. I mean, the basic thing is that you would have to do it gradually. It has to be mutual. We would have to see every step of the way that there was benefit involved and neither side was threatened and so forth. So in a sense, this is not, it's certainly not difficult to envisage. I mean, you have a federal structure which does some things, but not other things, and then gradually the unifying power perhaps becomes stronger as the economies become integrated, as societies become integrated, and so forth. So it has to be a long-term, gradual process. The problem has been that the South Koreans have dreamt of taking over the North, what they call the absorption of the North, a bit like West Germany took over East Germany. So I think the North Koreans are very conscious of that. So if the South Koreans were to attempt that, the whole thing would sort of break down. But if things go ahead gradually, to mutual benefit, one step at a time sort of thing, then, yeah, lots of problems can be solved.
Yeah, and certainly we could see potentially a realignment. If South Korea was able to exercise sovereignty, which again, that's the $64,000 question, because they're occupied and the U.S. has operational control over their military. But if they could have sovereignty, you'd have South Korea, 50 million people, North Korea, maybe 30 million people. That's 80 million people, highly educated population. South Korea is already perhaps the 10th biggest economy in the world. They border Russia and China. It wouldn't be that hard to re-envision a complete realignment in the northern part of the Asia-Pacific area. Do you see it that way? 30 seconds left.
Yeah, absolutely. No, the implications are immense. It would be a large economic entity. And this is one of the things the Japanese, of course, are particularly worried about because their population is actually declining. I mean, they're still, 120 million. So still quite a substantially bigger economy. But if the two Korean economies reunite and if the conditions are right, there will probably be fairly explosive growth within the Korean Peninsula. And as you say, it's well positioned next to China, next to Russia, next to Japan. It is a natural logistics hub in Northeast Asia. So it has all sorts of things going for it on the economic front.
Tim Beal, we're out of time. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Tim Beal, talk to us from New Zealand. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM or 1390 AM. You can also hear us at Spotify, iHeartRadio, iTunes Radio, and Spreaker. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.